slightly from the waist. The sword cut through his sleeve and scratched his forearm. A piece of his sleeve fell off, giving Osugi the chance to see blood on the white lining.
"I've wounded him!"
she screamed in ecstasy, waving her sword wildly. She was as proud as if she had felled a great tree in one stroke, and the fact that Musashi wasn't fighting back in no way dimmed her elation. She went on shouting the name of the Kangon of Kiyomizu-dera, calling the deity down to earth. In a noisy frenzy, she ran around him, attacking him from front and back. Musashi did no more than shift his body to avoid the blows. His eye bothered him, and there was the scratch on his forearm. Although he had seen the blow coming, he had not moved quickly enough to avoid it. Never before had anyone gotten the jump on him or wounded him even slightly, and since he had not taken Osugi's attack seriously, the question of who would win, who lose, had never crossed his mind. But was it not true that by not taking her seriously, he had let himself be wounded? According to the art of war, no matter how slight the wound, he had quite clearly been beaten. The old woman's faith and the point of her sword had exposed for all to see his lack of maturity. "I was wrong," he thought. Seeing the folly of inaction, he jumped away from the attacking sword and slapped Osugi heavily on the back, sending her sprawling and her sword flying out of her hand. With his left hand, Musashi picked up the sword and with his right, lifted Osugi into the crook of his arm.
"Let me down!" she screamed, beating the air with her hands. "Are there no gods? No bodhisattvas? I've already wounded him once. What am I going to do? Musashi! Don't shame me like this! Cut off my head! Kill me now!"
While Musashi, tight-lipped, strode along the path with the struggling woman under his arm, she continued her hoarse protest.
"It's the fortunes of war. It's destiny. If this is the will of the gods, I'll not be a coward. When Matahachi hears Uncle Gon died and I was killed trying to take revenge, he'll rise up in anger and avenge us both. It'll be good medicine for him. Musashi, kill me. Kill me now. Where are you going? Are you trying to add disgrace to my death? Stop! Cut off my head now!"
Musashi paid no attention, but when he arrived at the bridge, he began to wonder what he was going to do with her. An inspiration came. Going down to the river, he found a boat tied to one of the bridge piers. Gently, he lowered her into it. "Now you just be patient and stay here for a while. Matahachi will be here soon."
"What are you doing?"
she cried, trying to push aside his hands and the reed mats in the bottom of the boat at the same time.
"Why should Matahachi's coming here make any difference? What makes you think he's coming? I know what you're up to. You're not satisfied with just killing me. You want to humiliate me too."
"Think what you like. It won't be long before you learn the truth."
"Kill me! Ha ha! What's so funny? You should have no trouble cutting through this old neck with one swift stroke."
For lack of a better way of keeping her put, he tied her to the raised keel of the boat. He then slid her sword back into its scabbard and lay it down neatly by her side. As he started to leave, she taunted him, saying,
"Musashi, I don't think you understand the way of the samurai. Come back here, and I'll teach you."
"Later." He started up the dike, but she was making such a racket, he had to go back and pile several reed mats over her. A huge red sun sprang up in flames above Higashiyama. Musashi watched fascinated as it climbed, feeling its rays pierce the inner depths of his being. He grew reflective, thinking that only once a year, when this new sun rose, did the little worm of ego that binds man to his tiny thoughts have the chance to melt and vanish under its magnificent light. Musashi was filled with the joy of being alive. Exultant, he shouted in the radiant dawn, "I'm still young!" The Great Bridge at Gojo Avenue. Field of the Rendaiji, 9th day of the first month. Reading the words made Musashi's blood surge. His attention was distracted, however, by a sharp, stabbing pain in his left eye. Lifting his hand to his eyelid, he noticed a small needle stuck into his kimono sleeve, and a closer look revealed 4 or 5 more embedded in his clothing, shining like slivers of ice in the morning light. "So that's it," he exclaimed, pulling one out and examining it. It was about the size of a small sewing needle, but had no threading eye and was triangular instead of round. "Why, the old bitch," he said with a shudder, glancing down toward the boat. "I've heard about blow needles, but whoever would have thought the old hag could shoot them? That was a pretty close call." With his usual curiosity, he gathered the needles one by one, then pinned them securely into his collar with the intention of studying them later on. He'd heard that among warriors there were 2 opposing schools of thought regarding these small weapons. One held that they could be effectively employed as a deterrent by blowing them into an enemy's face, while the other maintained that this was nonsense. The proponents held that a very old technique for the needle's employment had been developed from a game played by seamstresses and weavers who migrated from China to Japan in the 6th or 7th century. Although it was not considered a method of attack per se, they explained, it was practiced up until the time of the Ashikaga shogunate as a preliminary means of fending off an adversary. Those on the other side of the fence went so far as to claim that no ancient technique ever existed, although they did admit that needle blowing had been practiced as a game at one time. While conceding that women may have amused themselves in this fashion, they adamantly denied that needle blowing could be refined to the degree necessary to inflict injury. They also pointed out that saliva could absorb a certain amount of heat, cold, or acidity, but it could do little to absorb the pain caused by needles puncturing the inside of a person's mouth. The reply to this, of course, was that with enough practice, a person could learn to hold the needles in the mouth painlessly and to manipulate them with the tongue with a great deal of precision and force. Enough to blind a man. The non-believers then countered that even if the needles could be blown hard and fast, the chances of hurting anyone were minimal. After all, they said, the only parts of the face vulnerable to such attack were the eyes, and the chances of hitting them weren't very good, even under the best conditions. And unless the needle penetrated the pupil, the damage would be insignificant. After hearing most of these arguments at one time or another, Musashi had been inclined to side with the doubters. After this experience, he realized how premature his judgment had been and how important and useful randomly acquired bits of knowledge could subsequently prove to be. The needles had missed his pupil, but his eye was watering. As he felt around his clothing for something to dry it with, he heard the sound of cloth being torn. Turning, he saw a girl ripping a foot or so of red fabric from the sleeve of her undergarment. Akemi came running toward him. Her hair was not done up for the New Year celebration, and her kimono was bedraggled. She wore sandals, but no socks. Musashi squinted at her and muttered, though she looked familiar, he couldn't place the face.
"It's me, Takezo. I mean, Musashi," she said hesitantly, offering him the red cloth. "Did you get something in your eye? You shouldn't rub it. That'll only make it worse. Here, use this."
Musashi silently accepted her kindness and covered his eye with the cloth. Then he stared at her face intently.
"Don't you remember me?" she said incredulously. "But you must."
Musashi's face was a perfect blank.
"You must."
His silence broke the dam holding back her long pent-up emotions. Her spirit, so accustomed to unhappiness and cruelty, had clung to this one last hope, and now the light was dawning that it was nothing more than a fantasy of her own making. A hard lump formed in her breast, and she made a choking sound. Though she covered her mouth and nose to suppress the sobs, her shoulders quivered uncontrollably. Something about the way she looked when crying recalled the innocent girlishness of the days in Ibuki, when she'd carried the tinkling bell in her obi. Musashi put his arms around her thin, weak shoulders. "You're Akemi, of course. I remember. How do you happen to be here? It's such a surprise to see you. Don't you live in Ibuki anymore? What happened to your mother?" His questions were like barbs, the worst being the mention of Oko, which led naturally to his old friend. "Are you still living with Matahachi? He was supposed to come here this morning. You haven't by any chance seen him, have you?" Every word added to Akemi's misery. Nestled in his arms, she could do no more than shake her weeping head. "Isn't Matahachi coming?" he persisted. "What happened to him? How will I ever know if you just stand here and cry?"
He's not coming. He never got your message."
Akemi pressed her face against Musashi's chest and went into a new spasm of tears. She thought of saying this, of saying that, but each idea died in her feverish brain. How could she tell him of the horrid fate she had suffered because of her mother? How could she put into words what had happened in Sumiyoshi or in the days since then? The bridge was bathed in the New Year's sun, and more people were passing by. Girls in bright new kimono going to make their New Year's obeisance at Kiyomizudera. Men in formal robes starting their rounds of New Year's calls. Almost hidden among them was Jotaro, his gnomish thatch of hair in the same disheveled state as on any other day. He was nearly in the middle of the bridge when he caught sight of Musashi and Akemi. "What's all this?" he asked himself. "I thought he'd be with Otsu. That's not Otsu." He stopped and made a peculiar face. He was shocked to the core. It might have been all right if no one were watching, but there they were, chest to chest, embracing each other on a busy thoroughfare. A man and a woman hugging each other in public? It was shameless. He couldn't believe any grown-up could act so disgracefully, much less his own revered sensei. Jotaro's heart throbbed violently. He was both sad and a little jealous. And angry. So angry that he wanted to pick up a rock and throw it at them. "I've seen that woman somewhere," he thought. "Ah, she's the one who took Musashi's message for Matahachi. Well, she's a tea house girl, so what could you expect? But how on earth did they get to know one another? I think I should tell Otsu about this." He looked up and down the street and peered over the railing, but there was no sign of her. The previous night, confident that she would be meeting Musashi the next day, Otsu had washed her hair and stayed up till the early hours, doing it up in proper fashion. Then she had put on a kimono given her by the Karasumaru family, and, before dawn, set out to pay her respects at Gion Shrine and Kiyomizudera, before proceeding to Gojo Avenue. Jotaro had wanted to accompany her, but she had refused. Normally, it would be all right, she had explained, but today, Jotaro would be in the way. "You stay here," she said. "First, I want to talk to Musashi alone. You can come along to the bridge after it gets light, but take your time. And don't worry. I promise I'll be waiting there with Musashi when you come." Jotaro had been more than a little peeved. Not only was he old enough to understand Otsu's feelings, he also had a certain appreciation of the attraction men and women felt for each other. The experience of rolling about in the straw with Kocha and Koyagyu had not faded from his mind. Even so, it remained a mystery to him why a grown woman like Otsu went around moping and weeping all the time over a man. Search as he might, he could not find Otsu. While he fretted, Musashi and Akemi moved to the end of the bridge, presumably to avoid being so conspicuous. Musashi folded his arms and leaned on the railing. Akemi at his side looked down at the river. They did not notice Jotaro when he slipped by on the opposite side of the bridge. "Why is she taking so much time? How long can you pray to Kangnong?" Grumbling to himself, Jotaro stood on tiptoe and strained his eyes toward the hill at the end of Gojo Avenue. About 10 paces from where he was standing, there were 4 or 5 leafless willow trees. Often a flock of white herons gathered here along the river to catch fish, but today none were to be seen. A young man with a long forelock leaned against a willow branch, which stretched out toward the ground like a sleeping dragon. On the bridge, Musashi nodded as Akemi whispered fervently to him. She had thrown pride to the winds and was telling him everything, in the hope that she could persuade him to be hers alone. It was difficult to discern whether her words penetrated beyond his ears. Nod though he might, his look was not that of a lover saying sweet nothings to his beloved. On the contrary, his pupils shone with a colorless, heatless radiance and focused steadily on some particular object. Akemi did not notice this. Completely absorbed, she seemed to choke slightly as she tried to analyze her feelings.
"Oh," she sighed, "I've told you everything there is to tell. I haven't hidden anything."
Edging closer to him, she said wistfully,
"It's been more than 4 years since Sekigahara. I've changed both in body and in spirit."
Then, with a burst of tears,
"No, I haven't really changed. My feeling toward you hasn't changed a bit. I'm absolutely sure of that. Do you understand, Musashi? Do you understand how I feel?" "Please try to understand. I've told you everything. I'm not the innocent wildflower I was when we met at the foot of Mount Ibuki. I'm just an ordinary woman who's been violated. But is chastity a thing of the body or of the mind? Is a virgin who has lewd thoughts really chaste? I lost my virginity to, I can't say his name, but to a certain man, and yet my heart is pure." "Don't you feel anything for me at all? I can't keep secrets from the person I love. I wondered what to say when I saw you. Should I say anything or not? But then it became clear. I couldn't deceive you even if I wanted to. Please understand me. Say something. Say you forgive me. Or do you consider me despicable?" "When I think of it again, it makes me so furious."
She put her face down on the railing.
"You see, I'm ashamed to ask you to love me. I haven't the right to do that, but I'm still a virgin at heart. I still treasure my first love like a pearl. I haven't lost that treasure, and I won't, no matter what kind of life I lead, or what men I'm thrown together with."
Each hair of her head trembled with her sobbing. Under the bridge where her tears fell, the river, glistening in the New Year's sun, flowed on like Akemi's dreams toward an eternity of hope. While the poignance of her story elicited frequent nods and grunts, Musashi's eyes remained fixed on that point in the distance. His father had once remarked, "You're not like me. My eyes are black, but yours are dark brown. They say your grand-uncle, Hirata Shougen, had terrifying brown eyes, so maybe you take after him." At this moment, in the slanting rays of the sun, Musashi's eyes were a pure and flawless coral. "That has to be him," thought Sasaki Kojiro, the man leaning against the willow. He had heard of Musashi many times, but this was the first time he had set eyes on him. Musashi was wondering, who could he be? From the instant their eyes met, they had silently been searching, each sounding the depths of the other's spirit. In practicing the art of war, it is said that one must discern from the point of the enemy's sword the extent of his ability. This is exactly what the two men were doing. They were like wrestlers, sizing each other up before coming to grips. And each had reasons to regard the other with suspicion.
"I don't like it,"
thought Kojiro, seething with displeasure. He had taken care of Akemi since rescuing her from the deserted Amida Hall, and this patently intimate conversation between her and Musashi upset him. Maybe he's the kind who preys on innocent women. And her! She didn't say where she was going, and now she's up there weeping on a man's shoulder. He himself was here because he'd followed her. The enmity in Kojiro's eyes was not lost on Musashi, and he was also conscious of that peculiar instant conflict of wills that arises when one shugyosha encounters another. Nor was there any doubt that Kojiro felt the spirit of defiance conveyed in Musashi's expression.
"Who could he be?" thought Musashi again. "He looks like quite a fighter. But why the malicious look in his eye? Better watch him closely."
The intensity of the two men came not from their eyes, but from deep inside. Fireworks seemed about to shoot from their pupils. From appearances, Musashi might be a year or two younger than Kojiro, but then again, it might be the other way around. In either case, they shared one similarity. Both were at that age of maximum impudence when they were certain they knew everything there was to know about politics, society, the art of war, and all other subjects. As a vicious dog snarls when it sees another vicious dog, so both Musashi and Kojiro knew instinctively that the other was a dangerous fighter. Kojiro was the first to disengage his eyes, which he did with a slight grunt. Musashi, despite the touch of contempt he could see in Kojiro's profile, was convinced deep down that he'd won. The opponent had given in to his eyes, to his willpower, and this made Musashi happy.
"Akemi," he said, putting his hand on her shoulder.
Still sobbing with her face to the railing, she did not reply.
"Who's that man over there?"
"He's somebody who knows you, isn't he? I mean, the young man who looks like a student warrior. Just who is he?" Akemi was silent. She had not seen Kojiro until now, and the sight threw her tear-swollen face into confusion.
You mean that tall man over there?"
"Yes. Who is he?"
"Oh, he's, I don't know him very well."
"But you do know him, don't you?"
Yes.
Carrying that great long sword and dressed to attract attention, he must think he's quite a swordsman. How do you happen to know him?"
"A few days ago," Akemi said quickly, "I was bitten by a dog, and the bleeding wouldn't stop, so I went to a doctor in the place where he happened to be staying. He's been looking after me the past few days."
"In other words, you're living in the same house with him?"
"Yes, well, I'm living there, but it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing between us."
She spoke with more force now. "In that case, I suppose you don't know much about him. Do you know his name?"
"His name is Sasaki Kojiro. He's also called Gandyu."
"Gandyu?" He had heard that name before. Though not exceptionally famous, it was known among the warriors in a number of provinces. He was younger than Musashi had imagined him to be. He took another look at him. An odd thing happened then. A pair of dimples appeared in Kojiro's cheeks. Musashi smiled back. Yet this silent communication was not full of peaceful light and friendship, like the smile exchanged between the Buddha and his disciple Ananda as they rubbed flowers between their fingers. In Kojiro's smile were both a challenging jeer and an element of irony. Musashi's smile not only accepted Kojiro's challenge, but conveyed a fierce will to fight. Caught between these two strong-willed men, Akemi was about to start pouring out her feelings again, but before it came to that, Musashi said, "Now, Akemi, I think it'd be best for you to go back with that man to your lodgings. I'll come to see you soon. Don't worry."
"You'll really come?"
"Why, yes, of course."
"The name of the inn, it's the Zuzuya, in front of the Rokujo Avenue Monastery."
"I see." The casual manner of his reply was not enough for Akemi. She grabbed his hand from the railing and squeezed it passionately in the shadow of her sleeve.
He'll really come, won't you? Promise?
Musashi's reply was drowned by a burst of belly-splitting laughter.
Ha 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 ha! Oh ha ha ha!
Kojiro turned his back and walked away as best he could in view of his uncontrollable mirth. Looking on acidly from one end of the bridge, Jotaro thought, nothing could possibly be that funny. He himself was disgusted with the world, and particularly with his wayward teacher and with Otsu. Where could she have got to? He asked again as he started tramping angrily toward town. He had taken only a few steps when he spied Otsu's white face between the wheels of an ox cart standing at the next corner over. There she is, he shouted, then bumped into the ox's nose in his hurry to reach her. Today, for a change, Otsu had applied a little rouge to her lips. Her makeup was somewhat amateurish, but there was a pleasant scent about her, and her kimono was a lovely spring outfit with a white and green pattern embroidered on a deep pink background. Jotaro hugged her from behind, not caring whether he mussed her hair or smeared the white powder on her neck. Why are you hiding here? I've been waiting for hours. Come with me, quick! She made no reply. Come on, right now, he pleaded, shaking her by the shoulders. Musashi's here too. Look, you can see him from here. I'm mad at him myself, but let's go anyway. If we don't hurry, he'll be gone. When he took her wrist and tried to pull her to her feet, he noticed her arm was damp. Otsu, are you crying?
Joe, hide behind the wagon like me, please.
Why?
Never mind why.
Well, of all... Jotaro made no attempt to conceal his wrath. That's what I hate about women. They do crazy things. You keep saying you want to see Musashi and go weeping all over the place looking for him. Now that he's right in front of you, you decide to hide. You even want me to hide with you. Isn't that funny? Ha! Oh, I can't even laugh. The words stung like a whip. Lifting her swollen red eyes, she said,
Please don't talk that way. I beg you. Don't you be mean to me, too.
Why accuse me of being mean? What have I done?
Just be quiet, please, and stoop down here with me.
I can't. There's ox manure on the ground. You know, they say if you cry on New Year's Day, even the crows will laugh at you.
Oh, I don't care. I'm just...
Well, then, I'll laugh at you. Laugh like that samurai a few minutes ago. My first laugh of the New Year. Would that suit you?
Yes. Laugh. Laugh hard.
I can't, he said, wiping his nose. I'll bet I know what's wrong. You're jealous because Musashi was talking to that woman.
It's not that. It's not that at all.
Yes, it is. I know it is. It made me mad, too. But isn't that all the more reason for you to go and talk to him? You don't understand anything, do you? Otsu showed no signs of rising, but he tugged so hard at her wrist that she was forced to.
Stop! She cried. That hurts! Don't be so spiteful. You say I don't understand anything, but you don't have the slightest idea how I feel.
I know exactly how you feel. You're jealous.
That's not the only thing.
Quiet. Let's go. She emerged from behind the wagon, but not voluntarily. The boy pulled. Her feet scraped the ground. Still tugging, Jotaro craned his neck and looked toward the bridge.
Look, he said. Akemi's not there anymore. Akemi? Who's Akemi?
The girl Musashi was talking to.
Uh-oh, Musashi's walking away. If you don't come right now, he'll be gone.
Jotaro let go of Otsu and started toward the bridge.
Wait!
Cried Otsu, sweeping the bridge with her eyes to make sure Akemi wasn't lurking about somewhere. Assured that her rival was really gone, she appeared immensely relieved and her eyebrows unfurrowed. But back she went, behind the ox cart to dry her puffy eyes with her sleeve, smooth her hair and straighten her kimono.
Hurry, Otsu!
Jotaro called impatiently.
Musashi seems to have gone down to the riverbank. This is no time to primp. Where? Down to the riverbank. I don't know why, but that's where he went.
The two of them ran together to the end of the bridge, and Jotaro, with perfunctory apologies, made a way for them through the crowd to the railing. Musashi was standing by the boat where Osugi was still squirming around, trying to free her bonds.
"I'm sorry, Granny," he said, "but it seems Matahachi's not coming after all. I hope to see him in the near future and try to drum some courage into him. In the meantime, you yourself should try to find him and take him home to live with you like a good son. That'll be a far better way to express your gratitude to your ancestors than by trying to cut off my head."
He put his hand under the rush mats and with a small knife cut the rope.
"You talk too much, Musashi. I don't need any advice from you. Just make up your stupid mind what you're going to do. Are you going to kill me or be killed?"
Bright blue veins stood out all over her face as she struggled out from under the mats, but by the time she stood up, Musashi was crossing the river, jumping like a wagtail across the rocks and shoals. In no time he reached the opposite side and climbed to the top of the dike. Jotaro caught sight of him and cried,
"See, Otsu? There he is!"
The boy went straight down the dike, and she did the same. To Jotaro's nimble legs, rivers and mountains meant nothing, but Otsu, because of her fine kimono, came to a dead halt at the river's edge. Musashi was now out of sight, but there she stood, screaming his name at the top of her lungs.
"Otsu!"
came a reply from an unexpected quarter. Osugi was not 100 feet away. When Otsu saw who it was, she uttered a cry, covered her face with her hands for a moment, and ran. The old woman lost no time in giving chase, white hair flying in the wind.
"Otsu!"
she screamed, in a voice that might have parted the waters of the Kamo.
"Wait! I want to talk to you!"
An explanation for Otsu's presence was already taking shape in the old woman's suspicious mind. She felt sure Musashi had tied her up because he had a rendezvous with the girl today and had not wanted her to see this. Then, she reasoned, something Otsu said had annoyed him, and he had abandoned her. That, no doubt, was why she was wailing for him to come back.
"That girl is incorrigible," she said, hating Otsu even more than she hated Musashi.
In her mind, Otsu was rightfully her daughter-in-law, never mind whether the nuptials had actually taken place or not. The promise had been made. And if his fiancée had come to hate her son, she must also hate Osugi herself.
"Wait!"
she shrieked again, opening her mouth almost from ear to ear. The force of the scream startled Jotaro, who was right beside her. He grabbed hold of her and shouted,
"What are you trying to do, you old witch? Get out of my way!"
cried Osugi, shoving him aside. Jotaro did not know who she was, or why Otsu had fled at the sight of her, but he sensed that she meant danger. As the son of Aoki Tanzaemon and the sole student of Miyamoto Musashi, he refused to be pushed aside by an old hag's scrawny elbow.
"You can't do that to me!"
He caught up with her and leapt squarely on her back. She quickly shook him off, and taking his neck in the crook of her left arm, dealt him several sharp slaps.
"You little devil! This'll teach you to butt in!"
While Jotaro struggled to free himself, Otsu ran on, her mind in turmoil. She was young, and like most young people, full of hope, not in the habit of bemoaning her unhappy lot. She savored the delights of each new day as though they were flowers in a sunny garden. Sorrows and disappointments were facts of life, but they did not get her down for long. Likewise, she could not conceive of pleasure as completely divorced from pain. But today, she had been jolted out of her optimism, not once, but twice. Why, she wondered, had she ever come here this morning? Neither tears nor anger could nullify the shock. After thinking fleetingly of suicide, she had condemned all men as wicked liars. She had been, by turns, furious and miserable, hating the world, hating herself, too overcome to find release in tears or to think clearly about anything. Her blood boiled with jealousy, and the insecurity it caused made her scold herself for her many shortcomings, including her lack of poise at the moment. She told herself repeatedly to keep cool and gradually repressed her impulses beneath the veneer of dignity that women were supposed to maintain. The entire time that strange girl was at Musashi's side, Otsu had not been able to move. When Akemi left, however, forbearance was no longer possible, and Otsu felt irresistibly compelled to face Musashi and pour out how she felt. Although she had no idea where to begin, she resolved to open her heart and tell him everything. But life is full of tiny accidents. One small misstep, a minute miscalculation made in the heat of the moment, can, in many instances, alter the shape of things to come for months or years. It was by letting Musashi out of her sight for a second that Otsu exposed herself to Osugi. On this glorious New Year's morning, Otsu's Garden of Delights was overrun by snakes. It was a nightmare come true. In many a frenzied dream, she had encountered Osugi's leering face, and here was the stark reality bearing down on her. Completely winded after running several hundred yards, she halted and looked back. For a moment, her breath stopped altogether. Osugi, about 100 yards away, was hitting Jotaro and swinging him around this way and that. He fought back, kicking the ground, kicking the air, landing an occasional blow on his captor. Otsu saw that it would be only a matter of moments before he succeeded in drawing his wooden sword, and when he did, it was a dead certainty the old woman would not only unsheathe her short sword, but show no compunction about using it. At a time like this, Osugi was not one to show mercy. Jotaro might well be killed. Otsu was in a terrible predicament. Jotaro had to be rescued, but she dared not approach Osugi. Jotaro did succeed in getting his wooden sword free of his obi, but not in extracting his head from Osugi's vice-like grip. All his kicking and flailing were working against him, because they increased the old woman's self-confidence.
"Brat!" she cried snidely. "What are you trying to do, imitate a frog?"
The way her front teeth jutted out made her look hare-lipped, but her expression was one of hideous triumph. Step by scraping step, she pressed on toward Otsu. As she glared at the terrified girl, her natural cunning asserted itself. In a flash, it came to her that she was going about this the wrong way. If the opponent had been Musashi, trickery would not work, but the enemy before her was Otsu, tender, innocent Otsu, who could probably be made to believe anything, provided it was put to her gently and with an air of sincerity. First tie her up with words, thought Osugi, then roast her for dinner.
"Otsu!" she called in an earnestly poignant tone. "Why are you running away? What makes you flee the minute you lay eyes on me? You did the same thing at the Mikazuki tea house. I can't understand it. You must be imagining things. I haven't the slightest intention of doing you any harm."
An expression of doubt crept over Otsu's face, but Jotaro, still captive, asked,
"Is that true, Granny? Do you mean it?"
"Why, of course. Otsu doesn't understand how I really feel. She seems to be afraid of me."
"If you mean that, then let go of me, and I'll go get her."
"Not so fast. If I let you go, how do I know you won't hit me with that sword of yours and run away?
Do you think I'm a coward? I'd never do anything like that. It looks to me as though we're fighting over nothing. There's been a mistake somewhere."
"All right. You go to Otsu and tell her I'm not angry at her anymore. There was a time when I was, but that's all over. Since Uncle Gon died, I've been wandering around all by myself, carrying his ashes at my side, a lonely old lady with no place to go. Explain to her that whatever my feelings about Musashi, I still look upon her as a daughter. I'm not asking her to come back and be Matahachi's bride. I only hope she'll take pity on me and listen to what I have to say.
That's enough. Any more, and I won't be able to remember it all.
All right, just tell her what I've said so far.
While the boy ran to Otsu and repeated Osugi's message, the old woman, pretending not to watch, sat down on a rock and gazed toward a shoal where a school of minnows were making patterns in the water. Would Otsu come, or would she not? Osugi stole a glance faster than the lightning movements of the tiny fish. Otsu's doubts were not easily dispelled, but eventually Jotaro convinced her there was no danger. Timidly, she began walking toward Osugi, who, reveling in her victory, smiled broadly.
"Otsu, my dear girl," she said in a motherly tone.
"Granny," replied Otsu, bowing to the ground at the old woman's feet. "Forgive me. Please forgive me. I don't know what to say."
"There's no need for you to say anything. It's all Matahachi's fault. Apparently, he still resents your change of heart, and at one time, I'm afraid, I thought ill of you too. But that's all water under the bridge."
"Then you'll pardon me for the way I acted?"
"Well, now," said Osugi, introducing a note of uncertainty,
but at the same time squatting down beside Otsu. Otsu picked at the sand with her fingers, scratching a small hole in the cold surface. Tepid water bubbled to the surface.
"As Matahachi's mother, I suppose I can say that you've been forgiven. But then there's Matahachi to consider. Won't you see him and talk to him again? Since he ran off with another woman of his own free will, I don't think he'd ask you to come back to him. In fact, I wouldn't permit him to do anything so selfish. But..."
"Yes?"
"Well, won't you at least agree to seeing him? Then, with the two of you there side by side, I'll tell him exactly what's what. That way, I'll be able to fulfill my duty as a mother. I'll feel I've done everything I could."
"I see," replied Otsu.
From the sand beside her, a baby crab crawled out and scurried behind a rock. Jotaro latched onto it, went behind Osugi, and dropped it on the top of her head. Otsu said,
"But I can't help feeling that after all this time, it would be better for me not to see Matahachi. I'll be right there with you. Wouldn't you feel better if you saw him and made a clean break of it?"
"Yes,
but then do it. I say this for the sake of your own future."
"If I agree, how are we to find Matahachi? Do you know where he is?"
I can find him very quickly, very quickly. You see, I saw him quite recently in Osaka. He got into one of his willful moods and went off and left me in Sumiyoshi. But when he does things like that, he always regrets them later. It won't be long before he shows up in Kyoto looking for me."
Despite Otsu's uncomfortable feeling that Osugi wasn't telling the truth, she was swayed by the old woman's faith in her worthless son. What led to her final surrender, however, was the conviction that the course proposed by Osugi was right and proper.
"How would it be," she asked, "if I went and helped you look for Matahachi?"
"Oh, would you?"
cried Osugi, taking the girl's hand in her own.
"Yes, yes, I think I should."
"All right, come with me now to my inn." "Ouch! What's this?"
Standing up, she put her hand to the back of her collar and caught the crab. With a shiver, she exclaimed,
"Now how did that get there?"
She held out her hand and shook it loose from her fingers.
Jotaro, who was behind her, suppressed a snicker, but Osugi was not fooled. With flashing eyes, she turned and glared at him.
"Some of your mischief, I suppose."
"Not me. I didn't do it."
He ran up the dike for safety and called, "Otsu, are you going with her to her inn?" Before Otsu could answer for herself, Osugi said,
"Yes, she's coming with me. I'm staying at an inn near the foot of Sannen Hill. I always stay there when I come to Kyoto. We won't be needing you. You go back to wherever you came from."
"All right, I'll be at the Karasumaru house. You come too, Otsu, when you've finished your business."
Otsu felt a twinge of anxiety.
"Joe, wait!"
She ran quickly up the dike, reluctant to let him go. Osugi, fearing the girl might change her mind and flee, was quick to follow, but for a few seconds, Otsu and Jotaro were alone.
"I think I have to go with her," said Otsu. "But I'll come to Lord Karasumaru's whenever I have a chance. Explain everything to them, and get them to let you stay until I've finished what I have to do. Don't worry, I'll wait as long as necessary. Look for Musashi while you're waiting, won't you?"
"There you go again. When you finally find him, you hide, and now you're sorry. Don't say I didn't warn you."
"It was very foolish of me."
Osugi arrived and inserted herself between the two. The trio started walking back to the bridge, Osugi's needle-like glance darting frequently toward Otsu, whom she dared not trust. Although Otsu had not the slightest inkling of the perilous fate that lay before her, she nevertheless had the feeling of being trapped. When they arrived back at the bridge, the sun was high above the willows and the pines and the streets well filled with the New Year's throng. A sizable group had congregated before the sign posted on the bridge.
"Musashi? Who's that?
Do you know any great swordsman by that name?"
"Never heard of him.
Must be quite a fighter if he's taking on the Yoshiokas. That should be something to see."
Otsu came to a halt and stared. Osugi and Jotaro too stopped and looked, listening to the softly reverberating whisper. Like the ripples caused by minnows in the shoal, the name Musashi spread through the crowd.
Book 4. Wind. The Withered Field.
The swordsmen from the Yoshioka school assembled in a barren field overlooking the Nagasaka entrance to the Tamba High Road. Beyond the trees edging the field, the glistening of the snow in the mountains northwest of Kyoto struck the eye like lightning. One of the men suggested making a fire, pointing out that their sheathed swords seemed to act like conduits, transmitting the cold directly to their bodies. It was the very beginning of spring, the ninth day of the new year. A frigid wind blew down from Mount Kinugasa, and even the birds sounded forlorn.
"Burns nice, doesn't it?
Better be careful. Don't want to start a brush fire."
The crackling fire warmed their hands and faces, but before long, Ueda Ryohei, waving smoke from his eyes, grumbled,
"It's too hot!"
Glaring at a man who was about to throw more leaves on the fire, he said,
"That's enough! Stop!"
An hour passed uneventfully.
"It must be past 6 o'clock already."
To a man, without giving it a thought, they lifted their eyes toward the sun.
"Closer to 7.
The young master should be here by now."
"Oh, he'll show up any minute."
Faces tense, they anxiously watched the road from town. Not a few were swallowing nervously.
"What could have happened to him?"
A cow lowed, breaking the silence. The field had once been used as pasture for the emperor's cows, and there were still untended cows in the vicinity. The sun rose higher, bringing with it warmth and the odor of manure and dried grass.
"Don't you suppose Musashi's already at the field by that Endaiji?"
"He may be."
"Somebody go and take a look. It's only about 600 yards.
No one was eager to do this. They lapsed into silence again, their faces smoldering in the shadows cast by the smoke.
"There's no misunderstanding about the arrangements, is there?" No, Ueda got it directly from the young master last night. There couldn't be any mistake.
Ryohei confirmed this.
That's right. I wouldn't be surprised if Musashi's there already, but maybe the young master's deliberately coming late to make Musashi nervous. Let's wait. If we make a false move and give people the impression we're going to the aid of the young master, it'll disgrace the school. We can't do anything until he arrives. What's Musashi anyway? Just a ronin. He can't be that good.
The students who had seen Musashi in action at the Yoshioka Dojo the previous year knew otherwise. But even to them, it was unthinkable that Seijuro would lose. The consensus was that though their master was bound to win, accidents do happen. Moreover, since the fight had been publicly announced, there would be a lot of spectators, whose presence, they felt, would not only add to the prestige of the school, but enhance the personal reputation of their teacher. Despite Seijuro's specific instructions that they were under no circumstances to assist him, 40 of them had gathered here to await his arrival, give him a rousing send-off, and be on hand, just in case. Besides Ueda, 5 of the other 10 swordsmen of the house of Yoshioka were present. It was now past 7, and as the spirit of calm enjoined upon them by Ryohei gave way to boredom, they mumbled discontentedly. Spectators on their way to the bout were asking if there had been some mistake.
Where's Musashi? Where's the other one, Seijuro?
Who are all those samurai?
Probably here to second one side or the other.
Strange way to have a duel. The seconds are here, the principals aren't.
Though the crowd grew bigger and the buzz of voices louder, the onlookers were too prudent to approach the Yoshioka students, who, for their part, took no notice of the heads peering through the withered miscanthus or looking down from tree branches. Jotaro padded around in the midst of the mob, leaving a trail of little puffs of dust. Carrying his larger-than-life wooden sword and wearing sandals too big for him, he was going from woman to woman, checking one face after another.
Not here, not here, he murmured.
What could have happened to Otsu? She knows about the fight today. She had to be here, he thought. Musashi might be in danger. What could possibly keep her away? But his search was fruitless, though he trudged about until he was dead tired. It's so strange, he thought. I haven't seen her since New Year's Day. I wonder if she's sick. That old hag she went away with talked nice, but maybe it was a trick. Maybe she's done something awful to Otsu. This worried him terribly, far more than the outcome of today's bout. He had no misgivings about that. Of the hundreds of people in the crowd, there was hardly one who did not expect Seijuro to win. Only Jotaro was sustained by unshakable faith in Musashi. Before his eyes was a vision of his teacher facing the lances of the Hozoin priests at Hanya Plain. Finally, he stopped in the middle of the field. "There's something else strange," he mused. "Why are all these people here? According to the sign, the fight is to take place in the field by the Rendaiji." He seemed to be the only person puzzled by this. Out of the milling crowd came a surly voice.
"You there, boy! Look here!"
Jotaro recognized the man. He was the one who had been watching Musashi and Akemi whispering on the bridge on New Year's morning.
"What do you want, mister?"
asked Jotaro. Sasaki Kojiro came up to him, but before speaking, slowly eyed him from head to toe.
"Didn't I see you on Gojo Avenue recently?"
"Oh, so you remember.
You were with a young woman."
"Yes, that was Otsu."
"Is that her name? Tell me, does she have some connection with Musashi?"
"I should say so."
"Is she his cousin?"
"Uh-uh."
"Sister?"
"Uh-uh."
"Well?"
"She likes him."
"Are they lovers?"
"I don't know. I'm only his pupil." Jotaro nodded his head proudly.
"So that's why you're here. Look, the crowd's getting restless. You must know where Musashi is. Has he left his inn?"
"Why ask me? I haven't seen him for a long time." Several men pushed their way through the crowd and approached Kojiro. He turned a hawk-like eye on them.
Ah, so there you are, Sasaki.
Why, it's Ryohei.
Where have you been all this time?
Ryohei demanded, grabbing Kojiro's hand as though taking him prisoner.
You haven't been to the dojo for more than 10 days. The young master wanted to get in some practice with you.
So what if I stayed away? I'm here today. Placing themselves discreetly around Kojiro, Ryohei and his comrades led him off to their fire. The whisper went around among those who had seen Kojiro's long sword and his flashy outfit.
That's Musashi for sure.
Is that him?
It must be.
Pretty loud clothing he's got on. He doesn't look weak, though.
That's not Musashi,
Jotaro cried disdainfully.
Musashi's not like that at all. You'd never catch him dressed up like a kabuki actor.
Presently, even those who could not hear the boys protest realized their mistake and went back to wondering what was going on. Kojiro was standing with the Yoshioka students, regarding them with obvious contempt. They listened to him in silence, but their faces were sullen.
It was a blessing in disguise for the house of Yoshioka that neither Seijuro nor Musashi arrived on time, said Kojiro. What you'd better do is split up into groups, head Seijuro off and take him home quickly before he gets hurt.
This cowardly proposal enraged them, but he went further.
What I'm advising would do Seijuro more good than any assistance he could possibly get from you.
Then, rather grandly,
Heaven sent me here as a messenger for the sake of the house of Yoshioka. I shall give you my prediction. If they fight, Seijuro will lose. I'm sorry to have to say this, but Musashi will certainly defeat him, maybe kill him.
Miike Jurozaemon thrust his chest against the younger man's and shouted, That's an insult!
His right elbow between his own face and Kojiro's, he was prepared to draw and strike. Kojiro looked down and grinned.
I take it you don't like what I said?
Ugh!
In that case, I'm sorry,
said Kojiro blithely.
I won't attempt to be of further assistance.
Nobody asked for your help in the first place!
That's not quite right. If you had no need of my support, why did you insist that I come from Kema to your house? Why were you trying so hard to keep me happy? You, Seijuro, all of you.
We were simply being polite to a guest. You think a lot of yourself, don't you?
Ha 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 ha! Let's stop all this before it ends up with my having to fight all of you. But I warn you, if you don't heed my prophecy, you'll regret it. I've compared the two men with my own eyes, and I say the chances Seijuro will lose are overwhelming. Musashi was at the Gojo Avenue Bridge on New Year's morning. As soon as I laid eyes on him, I knew there was danger. To me, that sign you put up looks more like an announcement of mourning for the house of Yoshioka. It's very sad, but it seems to be the way of the world that people never realize when they're finished.
That's enough! Why come here if your only purpose is to talk like that?
Kojiro's tone became snide.
It also seems to be typical of people on the way down that they won't accept an act of kindness in the spirit in which it's offered. Go on, think what you like. You won't even have to wait the day out. You'll know in an hour or less how wrong you are.
Yuck!
Jurozaemon spat at Kojiro. 40 men moved a step forward, their anger radiating darkly over the field. Kojiro reacted with self-assurance. Jumping quickly to one side, he demonstrated by his stance that if they were looking for a fight, he was ready. The goodwill he had professed earlier now seemed a sham. An observer might well have asked if he wasn't using mob psychology to create an opportunity for himself to steal the show from Musashi and Seijuro. A stir of excitement spread through those close enough to see. This was not the fight they had come to watch, but it promised to be a good one. Into the midst of this murder-charged atmosphere ran a young girl. Speeding along behind her like a rolling ball was a small monkey. She rushed in between Kojiro and the Yoshioka swordsman and screamed,
Kojiro! Where's Musashi? Isn't he here?
Kojiro turned on her angrily. "What is this?" he demanded.
"Akemi," said one of the samurai. "What's she doing here?"
"Why did you come?" Kojiro snapped. "Didn't I tell you not to?"
"I'm not your